This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I've been reading segments from Carl Safino's wonderful book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002. We're going to continue today learning more about the ironic change over recent history from the threats being posed to albatrosses on their breeding islands by feather hunters to the threats out at sea where they spend most of their lives, the threat posed by fishing vessels that tow 30 to 80 mile long hooked lines. The albatross try to go for the bait on each hook. If they get hooked, they drown. But there is a hero in this story too, as well as last week we heard about Hiroshi Hasegawa, the hero who almost single-handedly has saved the short-tailed albatross and brought it back from near extinction. Millions of birds killed for their feathers on their breeding grounds. The short-tailed albatross has recovered beautifully because they're now protected on their breeding grounds. Now we need to learn about what longline fishing is all about and some wonderful people that are making longline commercial fishing much, much safer for the seabirds that swirl around trying to find food as these hooked and baited longlines play out off the sterns of these vessels. So we'll be in Alaska with Captain Mark Lunston. I'm reading from the chapter called Working in Overdrive, and we'll start talking again about the short-tailed albatross, now flying again and breeding again in the Pacific. Nevertheless, the short-tailed albatross remains endangered, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has decided that if fishery observers report more than two short-tails killed by Alaska longline fishing boats this year, they will likely close the year's fishing for the whole fleet. Of all the wildlife problems caused by fisheries, it's ironic that this albatross's problems originating with feather hunting as they did hang so pointedly over this fleet. In the Southern Ocean's subantarctic, where albatross populations are being driven downward because of longline fishing, much of the fishing is not under effective control. The irony is not lost on Mark Lunston, but here in Seward Harbor, on the deck of the Masonic, he's telling me that he stopped fighting and learned to love the short-tailed albatross. And so the short-tail has collected one more savior and proselytizer. Lunston's been in the forefront of efforts by Alaska longliners to develop not only methods but regulations for minimizing seabird mortality. I'm thankful he has because, A, it makes things a lot better for short-tailed, black-footed, and lazen albatrosses, and B, it makes his fleet the only group of fishing boats in the world actually initiating regulatory efforts to reduce bird bykill, and C, he averted war with the conservation groups. The fleet Lunston is part of was getting hammered in the press over bird kills. It looked like regulations would be imposed from outside, so Mark helped find solutions that would work for both the birds and the fishing boats. Now Mark wants to show people that longline fishing doesn't have to be dangerous to birds, so he's issued a challenge. Anyone willing to observe firsthand the effectiveness of his efforts to solve the problem can get on his boat and see what the real world is like. And here I am. Longline fishing boats practice either drift longlining or bottom longlining. Both involve miles-long lines armed with thousands of baited hooks. Drift longlines are usually 30 to 80 miles long. The line is stored on an enormous spool on deck. They drift in the current. Their main targets are swordfish and tunas. They've deeply depleted Atlantic swordfish and marlins, as well as many shark species worldwide, and they have serious bykill problems, catching, killing, and largely wasting undersized fish and endangering sea turtles and birds. Bottom longlines, which Mark uses, are usually much shorter and are anchored to the seabed. Their bykill problems are fewer, and unlike the bottom dragnets called trawls that scour and degrade bottom habitat, they are relatively friendly to the sea floor as long as there is no branching coral in the area. The main bikill problem created by bottom longlines is mortality to seabirds trying to snatch the bait before the line sinks. From an ocean animal's perspective, longlines are a bit like minefields in the feeding grounds of the sea. At one time, albatrosses survived extermination only by being at sea. Today, most albatrosses are safe only on land, where they spend just 5% of their lives. Hunting and killing on land in decades past was certain to miss at least some islands and some nests and some birds. But nowadays, every albatross, no matter how remote its nest, finds numerous opportunities to die on a long line. If it does, and it has a chick in the nest, when it happens, the chick starves. Two fisheries causing the most trouble for albatrosses are problematic in other ways. One has severely depleted the southern bluefin tuna it is targeting. Japanese tastes and willingness to pay outlandish sums for giant bluefin tuna make that fish the world's most commercially valued and biologically undervalued. In the mid-1990s, a single 715-pound southern bluefin tuna sold at auction for $83,000. And I'll add here that in January of 2019, a 612-pound southern bluefin tuna sold for $3.1 million, a world record, at the Tokyo Toyosu Market. And now back to Carl Safina. Each year, fishers set over 100 million tuna-intended hooks, where the range of southern bluefins heavily overlaps that of the albatrosses. Worth too much money in Japan to be allowed to live anywhere, bluefins are depleted everywhere they swim. In the Pacific, Atlantic, Mediterranean, Indian, and Southern Oceans. Enter the trendy Chilean sea bass fishery, which started in the mid-1990s. Interestingly, there is no such thing as a Chilean sea bass. The fishery targets two species of big 100-pound fish, the Patagonian toothfish and the Antarctic toothfish. They live in cold, deep sub-Antarctic waters. They're caught not just near Chile, but all around the bottom of the world, exactly where most albatrosses breed. Many such boats operate illegally, unlicensed, poaching in closed waters or far exceeding their quota. Poachers in Antarctic waters take twice the legal catch. They inflict some of the worst seaboard mortality anywhere. And they get a renewed financial boost every time we buy what they've caught. The Australian albatross specialist Rosemary Gales wrote, "The future prospects of albatrosses are bleak." And Carl Safina writes, "I respectfully disagree. Here's why. A lot of work is going into changing things. The birds are now reasonably secure on their islands, where once they were hunted mercilessly. The main threat now comes from longline fishing, but where longline fishing pressure has softened, some albatross populations have begun to trend upward. For example, wanderer populations on Crozet and Kerguelen Islands in the Indian Ocean, which had plunged by more than half between 1960 and 1990, are now increasing because many longline boats have moved away from these birds' main feeding grounds after depleting the southern bluefin tuna they'd targeted. Antipodes albatrosses increased from about 800 pairs in the late 1960s to over 5,000 pairs by the mid-1990s, by far the largest known increase for any great albatross population. The short-tailed has been increasing at 7% per year. Full recovery of these species could still require well over a century, and others are in trouble, but the point is this. These birds were in very bad shape, yet things have changed for the better. If good people work hard and more people join them, more of these problems can turn to progress, and progress could eventually become success." Now we're going to learn more about Mark Lunston and his work. This is very heartening. Don't despair. Back to Carl Safina. We're in Seward, Alaska. Bad weather had us stuck in the harbor for a couple of days, and Mark and his crew were savoring the luxury. Just a few years ago, all the boats competed directly for a very limited catch on a very short season, and everyone was forced to fish regardless of the weather. But now, in the wheelhouse of the Masonic, Captain Lunston is discoursing on the works of Emily Dickinson and Sylvia Plath, apparently 2 decades as a survivor, in some of the harshest fishing conditions on Earth, have enhanced Mark's ear for poetry. Last week, he was several thousand miles from here, in Massachusetts, shopping for poetry books at the Harvard Coop. He'd been brought to Boston to advise a National Research Council panel evaluating different forms of fisheries management. Mark says, "People from New England can't seem to understand why we have fish left in Alaska. We tell them we just stick to the quota and we leave some for next year. They act like they can't relate. And look at the disaster they have." Mark sees his fishery for sablefish, also called black cod, and Pacific halibut improving. Meanwhile, Atlantic cod and Atlantic halibut are spectacular casualties in the demolition derby that has been New England fishing. Populations of both species, depleted from decades of overfishing, remain on the ropes over most of their Atlantic range at or near all-time lows off New England, the Canadian Maritimes, and across Northern Europe. The human toll is depressed communities. Thousands of people in once proud fishing families who lost the livelihoods that were their means of understanding who they were, and large areas closed to fishing, with only hopes the fish will recover someday. Mark is a leading proponent of a rather new approach to fishery management called individual transferable quotas, ITQs for short. Some fisheries are still unmanaged, open to all comers, and limited only by what a boat can catch. The results are typically disastrous: depletion of fish, dislocation of fishers. More and more, fisheries are managed in some way. In a typically managed commercial fishery, a total catch quota is established as a limit. When the boats collectively reach the quota, the fishery is closed for the season for all participants. This causes each boat to try to catch as many fish as possible before the overall quota is reached and the fishing stopped. The intense competition this race creates is called a derby, because all the boats are competing directly. Fishing industry lobbyists exert political pressure to leave the season open longer or increase the quota, resulting in overfishing and depletion. New England and the Canadian Maritimes and a lot of other places largely destroyed their fisheries through simple greed. As more and more people got in, political pressures prevented fishery managers from accepting the fact that scientists kept flagging. The amount of fish was finite. More and more boats caught more and more fish until they all started catching fewer and fewer. And finally, boats and fishing businesses themselves went belly up. In Alaska, as more and more people got in, fishery managers fiercely held the line on the number of fish caught, which was very wise, but they did so by reducing the length of open seasons to just a few days. At the most extreme, halibut seasons were as short as 24 hours, twice a year. Because these managers always understood that a fishery relies on healthy fish populations, Alaska's most important fish populations remain robust. And nowadays, the intense competition and absurdly short seasons are a thing of the past because of the ITQ system, the individual transferable quotas. With ITQs, each boat owns shares of an overall quota that is determined by scientists. Moreover, each boat owner can buy or sell, that is, can transfer all or some of their shares. Boat owners, boat captains, and crew members can all buy and sell shares. In many other fisheries, unprofitable or marginal boats are often trapped into continued fishing to repay debts, thus continuing the political pressure to keep the quotas too high. ITQs allow fishers to either sell their way out of fishing or accumulate shares. For those who stay in, consolidation means less competition, more fish to catch, and more money to earn. They are at liberty and leisure to catch their share as quickly or slowly as they wish. The race for the fish and the derbies becomes things of the past, memories of the bad old days. Yet only a few fisheries are managed this way, and proposals for wider application of the approach have met considerable resistance. Critics include some conservation groups and many owner-operators. They fear excessive accumulation of shares, corporate fishing, and the end of smaller owner-operated boats, pointing to timber companies that have clear-cut lands they own, destroying forests for the trees and money. They also say that ownership doesn't intrinsically yield good stewardship. They're right. That can happen. But Mark rebuts their point. Quote, they insist ITQs will lead to corporate dominance, vertical integration, and loss of owner-operators. I'm proof it doesn't have to be that way, that it can work. Mark says that in his fishery, the system has the needed safeguard, a cap on accumulation, that has preserved the small owner-operators. It has established and professionalized the crews by giving them more future security, and it has helped conserve the fish. In New England, where Mark met resistance, crews often change from one trip to the next, sometimes culled from local bars when it's time for the boat to leave, as people drift in and out of the fishery because the race for fish and depletion have made fishing there so unprofitable. But old habits are dying a hard death. Quote, I can talk about success until I'm blue in the face, Mark says exasperatedly. They don't listen. Closing in on his 50th birthday, Mark has a smooth, full-bodied radio announcer's voice. He's a brown-haired, flannel and fleece sort of guy with sincere, somewhat somber blue-gray eyes. He's also a large, solid man, sized to match the task of resting a living where the greatest ocean meets the great land. Mark grew up in Colorado and earned a baccalaureate degree in English. Quote, after college, I wanted to go either to the Southwest or Northwest. My girlfriend wanted to be near the ocean, so ocean is what I got, plus a wife. I started graduate school part-time, got a job at a Seattle shipyard, but I couldn't handle academic politics, and I couldn't sit and read all day. I didn't drop out or anything. I just never showed up for the third quarter. I liked the shipyard's manual labor. It was good training for owning a boat like this. Halibut boats had the reputation as the real professionals, the guys who went up to Alaska and really fished. While I was doing some welding on a halibut boat, I asked the captain for a job, wound up fishing with him for about 6 years in the late 70s. During that time, the fishery got real crowded. It turned into hell. It got so miserable and difficult in the derbies, I almost quit 4 times. I had my little speech to the boss all rehearsed, but I'm glad I didn't. By the time I bought this boat, I pretty much knew what I was doing. But no matter how much you know, it's a shock to go from the deck to the wheelhouse. By luck, I bought this boat just as Japanese boats got kicked out of the federal waters. We were one of the first to go after sablefish, and with the Japanese out, the market just went up like this, he gestures with his hand. And so did fish abundance. But guys saw how well we were doing, and after a year or two, everybody was fishing sablefish. The derbies got incredible. God, it was horrible. Mark led the charge for, and finally got, a federally administered transferable quota system for both sablefish and Pacific halibut. That put the derby fishing out of its misery. Mark sees improvement in every aspect of the fishery. In the derby days, almost twice as many boats chased halibut in Alaskan waters as do today. Quote, in the derbies, lots of boats would set their gear in the same area. The first day you'd have great big fish, the second day you'd get about a third of what you had the first day, and the third day you'd have about a sixth. A lot of the gear was cross-laid, got chafed on each other, a lot of stuff broke off. It was a mess. Everyone lost expensive gear. Sad to say, a lot of hooked fish got left on the bottom. Now, Mark continues, we do everything systematically with a pattern. It's way more efficient. Now we have our fish to ourselves. We don't see anybody else fishing around us. We have high catch rates all the way through. And we'll actually fish about 50 days between mid-April and mid-August. It's so much better now. I'm going to continue next week. We'll be aboard Mark's vessel. Quoting from next week, this year the Masonic will achieve zero bird mortality. For the duration of the season, neither a fulmar nor an albatross and nary a gull will be drowned on a Masonic set hook. And next week we'll see how Mark Lunston achieves this. Remember, you can hear any of these episodes out of order. They all stand alone about the albatrosses and the Pacific Ocean at WDRT.org in the archive podcasts. If you're concerned about finding tuna that is sustainably and ethically commercially caught, not hurting the bird populations on the oceans, and you can feel good about, you can go to the Monterey Bay Aquarium website. They have a lot of information on recommended seafood that's caught ethically and sustainably. And the Viroqua Food Co-op sells delicious tuna species that is caught under those recommendations. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I've been reading segments of Carl Safina's book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival. Thank you for listening.